Hello, and welcome to Music Buddy, episode 22. Thanks for being here. Today, I welcome Mr. Tim Vesely, musician, songwriter, engineer, producer, Rio Static, and Violet Archer. Tim's back for his second guest appearance. He's my first repeat guest, which makes a lot of sense because he's an integral part of this podcast. He's the guy who records, mixes, and plays on the Music Buddy sessions. For those of you new to the podcast, the sessions are original songs that we record with some of our guests and which air at the end of those episodes. In fact, at the end of this episode, you'll hear a Music Buddy version of Tim's song, Rearview. We record these live off the floor at the Woodshed Studios in Toronto, where Tim's the house engineer. During those sessions, you'll find Tim doing triple duty as musician, sound engineer, and producer. I'm really lucky to have worked with Tim for several years now, not just with this project, but also with my own band. He's someone whose musical talents I cherish, and whose insights and observations I often find enlightening and entertaining. So let's hear what he has to say, shall we? Here's our conversation.
It's all feeling, it's all love. It's all connection, that human stuff. So tell me where you're coming.
Back on the hot seat.
Welcome back for another round.
Thanks.
So the first time you were on was episode 15, and I called that one the songwriter because we talked a lot about songwriting. You know, you do a lot of different things as a musician, and you're a sound engineer, and you work with other bands. You're not just a musician with the Rio Statics and the Violet Archers. You compose, you do a lot of different things. So I just wanted to get you back and talk about a wider range of what you do. And also I wanted to go through your Spotify playlist, which is called Formative Tracks, mm-hmm. and discuss a few of those tracks along the way as we go through the interview. We're going to stop and discuss a few songs that influenced you over the years. Does that sound good?
Sure. Let's do it.
Let's do it. So here we are, we're once again at the Woodshed where we record a lot of our sessions, and you are the house engineer here, and it's a pretty beautiful studio. I love being here. And how did you get the job here? When did you start?
I've been doing this about 12 years, I believe, and it just started, it was just sort of random and luck. It started off by doing just some odd jobs for somebody else. And then people in the building here were looking for somebody to hang some pictures and whatnot. And I said, yeah, and they called me. And so I started doing that. And then Chris, who was running the studio at the time, asked me to do some odd jobs for him in the studio. And then I started filling in. I said, hey, I do a bit of this myself. And I'd start filling in for him when he wasn't able to do a session. And so I learned the gear one piece at a time. Nice. And then eventually he moved on, to do other things. And I said, hey, I'll take over. And
right on.
And, somehow I ended up doing my dream job.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And at a great place. It's so central.
A great
to
place
Toronto.
With great, great people.
Do you still hang pictures? Did you hang that picture over there?
Yep. And,
Bobby
you'll
Orr?
Notice how it's perfectly level.
It looks pretty good, actually. Yeah. It's lined up.
Oh, no, I didn't hang Bobby Orr. That was here before I got here.
Very nice. Well, this is a beautiful space. I mean, it's a one, you know, to describe it to people who haven't been here, it's basically a one-room studio, right? The control booth is really just in the room with where the artists are.
That's right. It was explained to me that it was designed on the according to the Daniel Lanois philosophy.
Oh, okay.
Where he would rent a space or buy a space and set everything up, everyone up, including himself, up in one room. So they're all together. Everyone's, you know, on the same page. Everyone's creating the same thing. And you know, I didn't really put two and two together for the longest time, but every artist who has come in here and gets great results is always really happy. And a lot of it has to do with being relaxed and stuff. And then at one point it dawned on me that I think it has a lot to do with everyone being in the same room, because the bigger recording studios can be kind of intimidating and formal, where the artists are behind in the fishbowl behind the glass, you know, and the engineer or producer is in the other room looking at them as if they're on TV or something. And
it is very intimidating. Yeah,
it is. It's also cool to be in your own space, but mm-hmm. you know, if the engineer is annoying or whatever, it can be a good thing.
Yeah. Or if the engineer and producer want to talk trash about the artist, say, that's good. That really sucked.
Comes in handy that way too.
You can't do that without being behind glass.
Yeah, I gotta keep reminding myself, you know, I'm in the same room.
No trashing.
It's great. So it has its limitations as well, but it also has a lot of great stuff about it. So
I don't think I mentioned, but it's probably known that it's run by the band Blue Rodeo.
It's their studio.
Yeah.
I've been lucky enough to work a lot with those guys. I've done some, recorded some Blue Rodeo records, some Jim Cuddy Band records.
Yeah.
And struck up a great working relationship with them, and
nice
friendship relationship with them. I've really lucked out.
They got some talent. I think they're going to go places.
They're the easiest band to record because they're also awesome.
One heart pulled in two, each on a different track. Same road that carries you will one day bring you back. I will wait for you. Yes, I'll be here.
But in this room, I mean, you know, like you say, there's lots of benefits, but also probably some challenges. So I can see the benefits of, you know, there's a lot of wood in the room. It's a fairly big space. It's open. But what are the challenges that you find?
Really, the only one is not being able to hear when you're setting up and getting sounds, not being able to really isolate a sound and listen to it and tweak it.
Right.
Because you're in the same room. So if you're talking about a snare drum, the drummer's hitting the snare, you're hearing it more in the room than you are, through your speak monitors. You can't even really use the monitors.
Right.
While you're recording. So you'd have to use headphones, but you're still hearing more of the actual snare drum than you are the recorded.
Oh yeah, of course.
Recorded signal. So
yeah,
that's really the only limitation, because a lot of people like to spend a lot of time honing each individual sound, you know, EQing it and compressing it or whatever. So it was a bit of a learning curve to figure out, you know, what mic preamps, what microphones to use for each instrument but eventually you figure it out, and then you sort of stick with the same, more or less the same kind of routine for whatever project comes in. And yeah.
Does the fact that you can hear the subway going overhead ever pose problems? Because we're definitely right on the Danforth line.
It goes below, actually.
Oh yeah, of course. Sub. That's why it's called subway, right?
Yes.
Not.
We're not that far over. Yeah. We're on the main floor. We're pretty close to a subway, but that's part of the downtown sound.
For sure. Do you have a favorite piece of gear that you use over and over again without getting too, you know, techie? You were talking about just finding what microphones work best. And I guess you have to switch it up depending on the band and what kind of music they play. But is there one thing that you always go to?
Not really, because Chris, the guy who set up the studio and acquired a lot of the gear for the guys, just got a lot of great stuff, a lot of vintage stuff. We have a great Neumann U48 microphone, which is like what the Beatles sang into, that era, you know, early 60s. And it just sounds amazing. It's such a great vocal mic. Everybody sounds great singing on that. And it just looks cool. And it's, you know, it's from, it's very vintage and fun to use. But I mean, it's whatever works for an instrument or a voice or whatever is whatever sounds the best is, you know, my favorite thing at the time. So.
Do you spend a lot of time repairing the gear? I mean, I was looking at that new documentary about Abbey Road Studios called If These Walls Could Sing, and they have one of the sound engineers. Oh, no, it was actually Paul McCartney saying, you know, some studios you go into and things aren't working. Mm-hmm. And then in Abbey Road, they're always, everything's always working. I mean, I know they have a large staff.
Yeah.
But do you spend a lot of time fixing mics and
I don't fix them. Luckily, there is a guy that we know in Toronto who helps fix stuff. He's pretty busy, but it's sort of constant. There's always something that needs to be sent out for repairs, because that's the drawback of the vintage stuff is it acquires its own personality over the years, and sometimes it's good, sometimes not so good, and you never know exactly where each piece of gear is at, but as long as it sounds good or has some cool character to it, then you use it. I should say my favorite piece of gear in the studio is the Hammond C2 organ. It's my favorite instrument to record, and it's just so three-dimensional sounding when you record it, and it's always such a treat when somebody comes in who knows how to play it, because I sit down and I know how to play a keyboard, but I don't know how to coax a good sound out of the thing. There's so many buttons and sliders and everything on it. But when somebody comes in and knows how to play it, it's always a treat. It blows my mind.
That's a clip of Michael Fonfara, the late great, on the Hammond C2 organ, the one that's at the Woodshed. And that track was recorded by Tim and mixed by him. And it's called Mean to Me from the 2019 album Hazards of Glitter by Chris Houston. Okay, back to the interview. Well, let's get into one of the first tracks on your formative tracks set list.
Yeah, for some reason, I don't even remember why I did that, but I put together some of my favorite music over the years on a Spotify playlist. I don't know why I did it.
Why were you inspired?
I didn't know if other people could access it or not, but maybe I just did it for myself, just so I could listen to stuff. But I wanted to pick stuff from different eras of my musical awakening and put them together and just see what happened.
In the last interview that we did, you talked about when you write a song, it just, you know, no matter what, even if you want to try and sound like somebody else, it just comes out sounding like you. So I'm interested to hear what you think about, oh yeah, this song kind of reminds me of something I wrote, or I wish I could write more like that or something. But I mean, there's everything on this playlist. There's pop, there's country, there's reggae, soul, rock, art rock. It's a little bit of everything. The first song that comes up on the playlist is The Big Country by Talking Heads, from More Songs About Buildings and Food. And speaking of studios, you and the Rio Statics recorded at their studio, didn't you?
No, we recorded at a studio that they recorded that record at, actually, a Compass Point.
So it's one that they, but didn't they live, was it in the Bahamas?
In the Bahamas, yeah. Yes, I think Chris France and Tina Weymouth had an apartment right next to the studio. When we recorded there, we stayed in the same little complex there, right next door.
Oh, nice.
It was a treat to
do that. Were they there?
They weren't there, no.
Yeah.
at the time. But we thought, yeah, our producer suggested, hey, let's try, we'd always recorded in Toronto, and he suggested, let's try recording out of town. Like some people go to Moran Heights in Quebec or whatever. And and then at some point, he suggested, Michael Philip Voivoda suggested, let's go to Compass Point. Maybe he wanted a vacation or something. Yeah. And we said, yeah, because Talking Heads recorded there and a lot of other legendary artists and stuff. So yeah, we went down and spent, I don't know, a week, 2 weeks recording all the bed tracks for Introducing Happiness. Then we came back and mixed it overdubbed it at Grant Avenue in Hamilton, and then mixed it at Reaction Studios in Toronto.
Introducing Happiness. Happiness. Look who's found you someone. Look who stole you.
But this song, The Big Country, why did you choose this one in particular?
Talking Heads are a big influence for me, for sure. I went for their second record, more songs about buildings and food. Just, it's that kind of, I don't know, that era that I really love, I guess. They're quirky pop songs. And I think I remember reading that an interview with David Byrne talking about him wanting them to sound like Neil Young for that song. So that was was their version of being Neil Young.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because I listen to it. I think about that. I try to imagine. At one point, I think maybe the last time I listened to it, I thought, maybe I can hear a bit of, I think there's a bit of a slide guitar in there. So this was pretty funny.
Yeah, it is pretty funny.
But just sort of more of a random Talking Heads choice. I just love that. Love that band. And I just finished reading Chris France autobiography, Remain in Love. And I was amazed at how short their career was as a band.
Yeah.
So brief, like 77 to, I don't know, 80. Oh, I don't even know. No. But
yeah,
mid 80s. Very short. Chris France sort of described the band dynamics in the book and how it was sort of falling apart right from the start.
Oh,
and
that's too bad.
David Byrne just was always off on his own tangent, wanting to work with Brian Eno and bringing in different sounds and hot off the heels of making these great pop songs and great inventive original music, but already moving beyond it. It just blew me away and that happened within a few years, like their first four or five records, and then that was pretty much it.
I see the shapes I remember from maps. I see the shoreline. I see the white.
You also chose a song by The Jam. Which one was it? The Wasteland? And, you know, Paul Weller, you could maybe say, was similar to David Byrne in that respect, because he shut down The Jam, lasted I don't know how long, very long, and then Paul Weller went and formed the Style Council, much to many people's chagrin, I think, including yours.
Yeah, we don't have to talk about that, but yeah. One of my favorite artists of that era as well, Joe Jackson. I think his second third record, he was already doing like ska reggae. And then his fourth record was like a big band record.
Yeah. Was that Jumpin' Jive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're all great.
All great.
And then the fifth record had his like drum machine pop hit song, Steppin' Out.
Oh, yeah.
Such a quick career of moving on and moving on. And that was, I think that in itself was a real awakening for us as Rheostatics early on. Uh-huh. We want to keep exploring, keep breaking new ground.
Yeah.
And I think that part of it, maybe not the music so much, just that artistic drive to open up new windows,
see what's on the horizon. I think because a lot of fans probably would want certain bands to stay in the same place. So it must be very difficult, especially if you've gained a certain amount of popularity, to go, no, we're not going to do that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. But it makes the records you love even more special.
Yeah. And as an artist, it makes you want to keep doing it for the rest of your life, which David Byrne, mm-hmm. Joe Jackson, Paul Weller are still making great music today, right?
Exactly. Whereas if you do keep doing the same thing over and over, I don't think you last that long.
Get into a car and drive to the other side.
So when a band comes into the studio, I mean, you might have a full band walking in, or you might have a solo performer. If it's someone you haven't met, what's your initial approach to make things comfortable and to make people feel at ease and like they're artistically inclined?
That's exactly it. It's putting the person at ease and making them feel comfortable and trying to bring out the best that they can offer for the tape machine. So that's it. And yeah, so a lot of my role, the way I see it, is it's as much personal as it is, you know, technical or musical. It's knowing, reading the vibe of the room, especially with a band, like multiple people. It's you want to stay out of the way, but you want to keep it on track, you know. Recognize when things are going off the rails.
Crack a joke at the right time.
Yeah, I'm really spare with that. I really wait for a while. I don't, because I've been in situations where the technical people are a little too chummy. Like you want the artists to create an environment. It's their party. It's their whatever creative space.
Right.
You don't want to just jump in and say, hey, I'm a part of your group now.
Right.
You know, you want to, you sort of never want to do that. But eventually some artists make you feel comfortable enough that they invite you in. But I never, that's a big part of it, is staying on the sidelines. You got to straddle that. You got to be sort of coaxing the whole process along, and at the same time, be outside of it. You know, it's a fine line, but all the years of doing it as a musician is a big bonus for when you're working as an engineer or producer.
Yeah, I was going to say, you mostly call yourself an engineer, but you're also a producer a lot of the time, would you say?
It's a blurred line, and usually starts off as engineer and evolves into producer.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't even know that they need production, which is more, it's like production is like musical guidance. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't just need technical guidance. You also, in a way, need some people need the musical guidance just to know when to move on, when you've got something and it's time to move on, or when you're not getting something and you need to change something up, that sort of thing. And then the odd time, you know, suggesting song arrangement adjustments and things like that or whatever. And vocal coaching is a big part of it too, getting coaxing the best, kind of getting people comfortable because, you know, it's a totally different thing singing into a mic with headphones on by yourself as it is, you know, doing it for years on a stage with through a PA, which is what you're used to. So it's a whole new thing. Luckily, I know how to do both, or I've had experience with both and know how difficult it can be to make the transition. So
yeah, you're really good at that. Like, you've done a lot of that with me, and you're good at describing things just in the right way to make you go, oh, okay, yeah, I'll sing it that way instead. You've got the right set of metaphors or whatever's needed, or and to make the person, to make me or whoever the performer is, not feel like, oh, okay, I suck, you know, and get self-conscious. It, instead, you're just sort of encouraging them to think of it maybe another way.
I came close to going to a recording engineering college right out of high school. And not that it would have stopped me from being a musician, but I think the better education for this role is being a musician than actually studying the whatever technical side of stuff. Like, that's way more valuable. You can always learn whatever gear is in front of you, but to be able to know how to relate to artists and inspire them and such, that's it's probably a lot more difficult and requires a lot more experience. And so I'm happy with the way I evolved in this role.
I'll take the path of least resistance, and I'll take the path, I'll take the path of least resistance. Uptight, out of sight, someone's keeping it inside.
One thing you were saying in our previous interview is that you loved the sound of those old recordings, like you were talking about using vintage microphones, and you were just talking about the recordings. Some of the recordings you love are from the 1950s, 60s, when you'd have just great musicians, great engineers, amazing gear, and beautiful performances. And I was thinking about one of the tracks from your playlist. You chose Bring It On Home to Me, the Sam Cooke track. And I was thinking that was, I would say that's probably one of those tracks that just, the studio and everything just sounds so good. And let alone that he's one of the greatest soul singers of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's all, yeah. That's probably what I was thinking about, that track in particular, maybe when I was talking, trying to describe those kind of recordings. I mean, yeah, that's all about the performer, and the gear is very sparing, but luckily they made great stuff back then and were able to capture those kind of performances. So it is all about the performance. You can just hear, that recording just puts you in the space. It's so amazing.
And I just noticed there's a backup vocalist, a male backup vocalist on that track.
Oh yeah, I love that too. I love great harmony.
Well, a lot of your Violet Archer's songs have really great harmonies, and in those you're singing mostly with Ida Nilsson, aka Great Aunt Ida. And there's a track from her on your playlist. It's called Little Voice. It's from a 2006 album. Mm-hmm. The album's called How They Fly.
I got to know her. She was singing and playing with the Buttless Chaps.
Right. Dave doing Gowans?
Yeah. In some shows with Rios before I even heard her own stuff, and got her singing on some Violet Archer stuff. And then she played me some Great Aunt Ida stuff, which was, it just blew me away.
Yeah.
She had done one record, I think, Our Fall. And then the second, she was recording the second one. I helped a bit with the production maybe and a few maybe background vocals or something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. You are frightening. I am scared sometimes of your lightning. It makes it hard to run. You have the weight now. I feel everyone. And what if it were me, stuck in the same place?
Speaking of harmonies, there's a song on your playlist from Vic Chestnut, which is...
Oh, yeah.
Which has beautiful harmonies. I mean, there's a lot of great harmonies on this playlist.
The Vic Chestnut harmony is with Michael Stipe, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know if I chose that song in particular. Which song did I think I put...
The Vic Chestnut one is... Yeah, you've got two Vic Chestnut tracks. And the one with the harmonies is that I'm thinking of is called Woodrow Wilson.
Oh, yeah, that's, is that Emmylou Harris?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's always Emmylou.
And Michael Stipe sings on the record called Is the Actor Happy? And it's one of my favorite records of all time for so many reasons. Like, besides the music, that's one of the best sounding records I've ever heard.
It's beautiful.
Sounds so... So great.
Yeah, you've got
it. He's at the top of his game, and the songs are amazing, the singing. But I just love the sound of that record. The gravity of the situation is why our old thought bubble sang. Humble and gracious. Gravity of the situation, humble and gracious, the gravity of the situation, humble and gracious, the gravity of the situation, humble and gracious, the gravity of the situation, the gravity of the situation. We were talking about that Sam Cooke song and how great it sounds and how it captures the room they're playing in so perfectly. I'm assuming it was recorded live off the floor. Do you try to get as much when you're here recording stuff at the Woodshed? Do you try to get as much live off the floor as possible, or does it depend on the band? Yeah, it depends on the band or the artist. What they're capable of, and it generally lends to a better performance. I think overall my approach is get it live off the floor, but have the fallback plan in case. So, you know, stick the loud guitar amp out in the hallway in case you need to redo something. Because if everyone's in the same room bleeding into everyone's microphones, then that's the take. You record is the take you get. So,
yeah.
But you can also do multiple takes with everyone in the same room and then edit between takes.
Right.
So, I do that sometimes too. It's in the end, it depends on what the artist is capable of and go from there, but have as many options open as possible, I guess is a good approach.
I mean, and you're not against overdubbing. I mean, we do lots of stuff where we overdub. I mean, sometimes overdubbing is just a necessity, isn't it?
It can open up a lot of freedom too.
Yeah.
As well. But yeah, for sure. It all depends on the music and yeah.
And do you have favorite instruments that you like to record, or things that you think, like instruments that you think you're best at recording?
Besides the Hammond organ, which blows me away, just the sound of it.
Yeah.
I don't have a favorite. They're all their own challenge as far as recreating it as best as you can, or the way you hope it's going to come across on a recording. It never quite does sound the same as the way you hear it. So there are a lot of ways to approach it and a lot of ways to try to get it to make you as happy as possible and sound as true as possible. That's what I go for. But they all present their own unique challenges. So yeah, they're more all my nemeses than my favorites. Right. It's 'cause it's always a puzzle to put together.
How do you feel about brass and strings? Or like not necessarily together, I mean, just as...
Yeah, brass and strings, you have to, if there's like a combo of them, you know, quartet of strings or whatever, or a couple of horns, they have to play together and you record them mixing in the air. And I luckily get to do some string quartets in here. And that's the only way to do it is to put a couple of mics up over top of the players and capture what they're all doing together, because they blend in the air and then you record the air, as opposed to same with a group of horns. That's the way you got to approach that stuff.
It's a nice way of looking at it, recording the air.
Yeah.
Weren't you recording recently at a church, a space somewhere here in downtown Toronto?
Yeah, at St. Anne's.
Yeah.
The one with the group of seven frescoes on the ceilings. Such a beautiful place.
Wow.
And recorded a solo violin record with Anne Lindsay.
Oh yeah, right.
I've worked with her before and we're just putting that record together now. But
nice.
That was cool. That was definitely recording the air. Mm-hmm. I had like a mic sort of close to her and then a pair of mics capturing the ambience of the place and magical.
Amazing. Did you do like a walk around before you started recording?
We went to two churches. We had two options.
And oh yeah.
Picked St. Anne's. Just sounded better. It was also a little less noisy. It's difficult doing that because you're also recording noise, creaking floors and trucks driving by and stuff. So it's not ideal, but
they don't have the soundproofing that you do here, for example, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. But an inspiration for that record is a record I love called Camino by Oliver Schroer.
Oh, it's
it's a solo violin record. He's a fiddler and he walked the Camino Trail. Goes from Portugal through Spain or whatever. And
amazing.
Took a stereo portable recorder and recorded himself in all different churches and put it together. And it's a great record. You got to hear that.
A lot of the songs on this Formative Tracks playlist are very, to me, they're very honest. They're also unique and exploratory in a lot of ways. But you've got, you know, you've got Vic Chestnut on there and you've got Bob Snyder on there. And I know you're a big John Prine fan.
Mm-hmm.
But someone like Bob Snyder or John Prine or Vic Chestnut, what about their music? I mean, it's just sort of plain spoken, but profound at the same time, to me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What do you get from those guys?
Yeah, I put those guys in the same camp, the Bob Snyder and John Prine and Vic Chestnut and Dave Berman from the Silver Jews. They write perfect songs, just economical and perfect in musically and lyrically. And they also have these voices that just appeal to me. I need a quirky voice, I think, to catch my ear. There's a lot of great music I listen to that I just go, that's really great. But it doesn't get my heart, you know, it usually takes, I don't know, it takes something about the voice, the sound of the voice as well to really, get me. So I love those artists for all those reasons. Yeah. I like, that's what I like.
Yeah. Well, you chose that Silver Jews song.
Smith and Jones.
Yeah. Yeah. You chose Smith and Jones from Silver Jews.
That's such a dark song.
It's a very dark song.
So dark.
That's another thing I was going to say about some of these songs. They do have a lot of dark, and they've got light in them, but there's a balance. There's a lot of dark in some of these songs too, and a lot of melancholy.
Yeah, something I can't do and that I totally respect and love in writing is that humor that goes along with the profound and the dark. And the humor is something that I always aspire to, but I can't do it myself, but I love that when that happens.
Are you honest? When no one's looking, can you summon honey from a telephone? They sat there with their hooks in the water and their mustaches caked with airplane glue. Oh, come let us adore them California overboard. When the sun sets on the ghetto, all the broken stuff gets cold. Smith and Jones, forever. Smith and Jones.
What are some recent projects that you've worked on in here that you've enjoyed and feel good about, if you're allowed to talk about them yet?
Yeah, I got to record an album for Bobby Dove. I'd never met her before, but she had a band together with Basil from Blue Rodeo and some local musicians, and they came in, and she's straight up country. Nice. That was one of the projects where I started off as an engineer, and then the band kind of did their thing, and that was it. And then she still had a long road to go as far as figuring out how to make it so that she was happy. Mm-hmm. And so I became more producerly along the road, helping guide the way. And so it was a really unique working relationship we struck up. But the end result, great record, Hopeless Romantic.
Oh, is it out?
Yeah, it's been out for a bit. She's just like touring Europe now on it.
And, oh, amazing.
And I think she's really happy with it. And it's just something that came out of the blue, and I did not know where it was going to go. And it ended up just turning out really great. And it was a great process along the way. So, yeah.
You kick my funny bone each time you're near. I dump them over, laughing through my tears. Why can't you stop this? I can't say what's happening. I'm a known assassin when it comes to killing years. My heart's been stranded and I've been branded a hopeless romantic. My heart's been stranded and I've been branded a hopeless romantic. A hopeless romantic.
Colin Cripps has brought in a few times surf band called Surfer Jets. They're awesome.
All instrumental, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instrumental surf music from Port Perry, Ontario.
Right.
And we've done some great stuff. Like we did a full record, and then they came back and did a Halloween song and a Christmas song in the summer, because they plan ahead so well.
Fun.
But they're out touring as well and having a good time and fun stuff. It's cool being here, because it's always something cool that comes through the door, because it's sort of word of mouth kind of place, and more or less somehow related to the Blue Rodeo folks or crowd. So it's always something that's just up my alley.
Well, I like, it's nice how open-minded you are about music, and that's one of the things. I mean, you've got strong opinions, but you're very open to so many different styles. And getting to know you, I've learned a lot about the different, like, I would have never have thought of you as a John Prine fan or a country fan, or, you know, when I first got to know you, because you make assumptions about people based on the kind of music that they play, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, another pleasant surprise, I find out about you that you love Toots and the Maytals and reggae and Bob Marley. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of those on your playlist as well. And
Yeah. When I was younger, I would go through phases for like a year long or 2 year long phases. All I listened to was reggae.
Huh.
And like before that or after that, it was bluegrass. That's all I listened to. And, but I keep an open mind because I never know what I'm going to love, you know, or like the Palestrina choral music from the 14th century that I talked about in our little Christmas special.
That was stunning.
Got to keep an open mind because keep an open ear too. For something that catches your ear, and then you go and explore it, and that can become your next favorite thing.
Well, we all get stuck into our little genres or our little tunnel vision of what it is we think we're supposed to be listening to. And I mean, that's one of the great things about talking to other people about music is looking at these playlists. I mean, you're going to, you know, at least I know most of the bands on your playlist. I look at some playlists, I don't know any of the bands.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, well, where should I dive in first? And then sometimes you just discover the most amazing stuff. And we all just get in these patterns of what we listen to.
I think it's a good exercise for anyone to go, if they have Spotify thing, account or whatever, go and put together all your favorite songs from your different parts of your life and then listen back to it once. And it'll tell you a lot about yourself.
When you first hear a song, when you hear a new song, do you find yourself just diving into it fully and letting it kind of encompass you as a single unit? Or do you find yourself naturally analyzing certain aspects of a song?
Yeah, I guess depends on the music and whether what part of my brain it activates, whether it's the critical technical side. Sometimes I listen to a piece of music and it's like, how did they record that? I'm trying to picture where the piano was in the room or whatever. Or other times it's like immediately I'm drawn to the lyrics and wow, how did somebody write such a great couple of lines?
Yeah.
Or the voice. And at which point it just, you know, blows over me and soothes me and I don't think anything. I just love what I'm hearing.
Listening to
it. So it all depends on what part of my brain is triggered by whatever the music is. And it can go any number of ways, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Mm. I was listening to Living for the City, Stevie Wonder's song that you've got on here. And I had completely forgotten about that whole center section where he tells the story of the guy moving to New York and they're just talking. But it's just such a remarkable piece of music. I wouldn't even know where to start with analyzing it, really. I'd love to know how they recorded it and where they were.
I thought you were going to talk about that whole section of Stevie Wonder's career in the early to mid-70s when he made all these fantastic records. But then evolved into a different artist in the 80s started off as a different artist in the 60s and so much great music he's made. But I remember just loving Stevie Wonder from as young as I can remember. Uh-huh. Always been a Stevie Wonder fan. So I just sort of randomly went with that track, but I've loved everything he's done for sure.
With Rio Statics, you guys have worked with a lot of different producers and a lot of different studios. Are there any that stand out as just like the best possible experiences or?
More or less worked with one producer.
Michael Philip.
Michael Philip Voivoda, right from the very start.
Right.
Funny how we stuck stuck with him. So we've worked in a few different studios with Michael, but it's always sort of more or less the same experience. You know, I love the recording process because it's the point in the band's career or the artist's career where it's like a celebration of, I've just written these 10, 12 songs and arranged them and rehearsed them, and now it's time to put them down for other people to share with other people. And it's a real, not party, but it's a celebration point of the career, you know?
Yeah.
So I always feel lucky to be witnessing that and being a part of it with any artist that comes into the studio. It's one of the highlights for sure. And to be able to be a part of it is a real honor. And we always love the recording part, the Rios mm-hmm. do. And we always celebrate and fool around and come up with things on the fly in the studio and keep it that way, keep it fresh and open and creative and fun, really fun.
So Philip's probably almost like another member of the band at this point. And he has played, hasn't he played drums with you?
Yeah, he was our mid-era drummer. Yeah.
That's great. It's nice to have that continuity, creative continuity.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So the last album you did was with Rios was Here Come the Wolves. And Rear View is one of your songs that's on there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to play that today. Okay. We're going to do a Music Buddy session version of it. So I wanted to ask you about that song because I remember hearing the demo version or a previous version to the one that was on the album. And then the album one came out and it was, you know, it was a little bit different, but just more. It was bigger. It was
longer.
Is it longer?
No.
I don't think you added anything. So I just wanted to ask you about that song because the subject matter of the song is kind of... I mean, it's like we were talking about earlier. It's a little bit dark, but it's a little bit profound, and it's also kind of sweet in some ways, and it has lightness to it as well. So, I want to ask you how that song came into being before we sit down and play it.
Yeah.
Or any thoughts you have on it, you know?
Yeah. There you go. Ask me about talking about songwriting again.
Oh yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how that happened. How they,
we got right back
how
to
any
it.
Of them happen. Just sometimes it happens and you run with it. Other times it doesn't.
Mm.
So it's like kind of latched onto a bit of a chord change and a bit of a melody and a few lyrics and then went with it, and so it's sort of whatever few lyrics you start with, you have to make sense of and tell a story about, figure out what the story is, tell it in two and a half verses. Yeah. And sometimes it's the juxtaposition of the lyrical content with the music. I always try to keep the music bright, even if the lyrics aren't, because generally not interested in a lot of minor chords.
Interesting.
You can be minor with the lyrics.
Yeah.
And be major with the chords. When you're minor with both, it's a little too much for me, anyways, for my taste.
To me, this is a song about leaving Earth, right?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, you could take it as sad or terrifying or whatever. But for me, someone who's absolutely terrified of dying, this song is hopeful, strangely, weirdly comforting. So
That's funny.
And it's a great song.
Certainly never intended to write about the subject matter.
Interesting.
Just came out. So how do I deal with that? I guess I don't know. But definitely trying to keep a blue sky in there in the song.
There's definitely a blue sky. Well, your playlist is great. I mean, there's so much we didn't talk about on the playlist, but I'll obviously post a link to it and let people.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
Give a listen.
Yeah.
Maybe there'll be a Tim Vesely number 3 episode in season 2 and we'll, I don't know, talk about something. Maybe we'll talk about hockey in that one, hockey and music.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm all there for sure.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks. Let's jam.
Yeah, let's jam. Okay, here's Rear View, written by Tim Vesley, performed by Tim and me. Enjoy.
Someday you're gonna ride right out of town with the blinders on and the pedal down, and past the same roads I so traveled on. There's no doubling back. Are you moving straight on? Past the parking lots. Yeah, where you have found. And the grassy spot where they want to lay down. Past the golden towers. Rising higher and higher.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoy the podcast, please tell your friends, your family, your neighbors, people you see at the grocery store, the guy on the elliptical next to you at the gym, you know, whoever. If you have questions or comments, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me or DM me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. My email is jane@musicbuddy.ca. If you're feeling flush, we'd appreciate any donation you can make in order to keep the show up and humming. There are links on the website and also on Instagram. And you can also just go to musicbuddy.ca/donate. So a quick follow-up fact from the interview, that awesome male backup vocalist on the Sam Cooke track was singer, composer, record producer, and actor Lou Rawls. Lou won 3 Grammys for Best Male R&B Vocal Performance. Some of you also might remember him as the guy who sang the alphabet on the first season of Sesame Street. How about that? So that's all for this week. Music Buddy is brought to you by Morning Run Productions, where everything's A-OK. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Until then, may your view be limitless and inspiring.